the soul search and the place to be. You see?
All I gotta do is open work and pray.
People will come out and enjoy the song.
KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison at ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
You were a number, you weren't a name, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today, we are featuring audio from a talk that happened in Montreal on Sunday, December 5th. The talk was called Insurgent Love, Abolition and Domestic Homicide. The talk featured Montreal-based Black feminist community organizers and researchers Marlahen Lopez and Natalie Batreville interviewing white feminist writer and organizer Ardith Wynot. The call-out for the event described it as follows, quote, "How do we deal with dangerous forms of intimate violence in a post-carceral future? How can abolitionist frameworks help us tackle the most dangerous forms of intimate partner and family violence that can lead to homicide? How do we engage in transformative justice in the wake of a homicide? Join Ardith Wynot, Marlahen Lopez, and Natalie Batreville in a conversation about transformative, community-based, and abolitionist approaches to domestic homicide." The Prison Radio Show was there to record the talk. We didn't get our best audio ever, but we hope this is listenable. Obviously, a content warning that this talk features in-depth conversations about violence, including sexual violence. So without further ado, here's the first part of that talk.
So I would like to start by asking you, Ardith, to talk about how you came to this work on transformative justice and how you position yourself doing this work.
So I began my career working on family violence and intimate partner violence in 2001. So I was just a baby undergraduate student working as a victim services counselor with Halifax Regional Police. And I was already mistrustful of police going into this position. I was an activist. I'd been pepper sprayed and kettled and that sort of thing. So, you know, I went into it feeling mistrustful of the ways in which police would respond to survivors of family violence. But I came out of about 3 to 4 years in that work, firmly convinced that a criminal justice punitive approach to family violence was not effective, and that there had to be better ways to honor and protect those who are living in abusive homes, those who are facing violence. And so around 2007, 2008, I had a request from a warden in the women's prison, the federal women's facility in the Maritimes. And she asked me to come in and run a poetry program. I started working with prisoners in the maximum security unit, mostly women and other gender nonconforming folks, and then later with men serving life sentences. So I kind of got both ends of the spectrum from, you know, those who were living in prisons, some on multiple life sentences for acts of extreme violence, and then also working with those who were looking every day at the failures of the criminal justice system. And so, you know, I became a student of Black feminism, of abolitionist thought. To me, it was not a philosophical position that I intellectually came to. It was because it was the most pragmatic set of ideas that I could find that was reflecting what I was seeing in my work.
Let's talk about language. Language has always been an issue within the violence against women movement. Some debate whether we should use the term violence against women or gender-based violence, domestic or intimate partner violence, etc. I want to ask you about your choice of language for the title and throughout your book. You chose to use the term domestic homicide, while a large faction of the violence against women movement has strongly advocated calling every homicide of a woman a femicide. So what led you to use the term domestic homicide? You also talk about family violence. What is at stake for each of these terms?
Yeah, that's a tough question. That was the bulk of the work going into the book, was me trying to sort that out. So femicide is, you know, what advocates say is the killing of women and girls for a gender-related reason. And so there's an international movement for tracking femicides and for collecting better data on the killing of women and girls. And I don't see anything wrong with that movement per se, but from my experience, what I was seeing working in intimate partner violence is that a lot of intimate partner homicides, about half of them, include the attempted suicide or successful suicide of the perpetrator. So there are multiple victim crimes, and in about a fifth of intimate partner homicides, you're seeing the death of children, of elders, and in some cases of bystanders. And of course, the Portapique shooting, most recently in Nova Scotia, shows you how much an intimate partner or attempted intimate partner homicide can lead to the deaths of bystanders. And for me, I don't see any utility in excluding victims of those crimes who might not be women. To me, that doesn't help us get at the story of that data. And it's not that we don't need data on how many women and girls are being killed, but often, and this is something that Beth Ritchie has really criticized, are the ways in which the professionalized domestic violence industry kind of tells a story about violence against women and girls as being the result of misogyny. They're like, okay, men hate women, male supremacy, it's patriarchy. And I'm a feminist and I don't disagree with that. But when the story ends there, what it does is it works to conceal the causes of misogyny, which I argue in the book largely come from settler colonialism, and men's violence is perpetuated by racial capitalism. So when we only talk about misogyny and when the conversation ends there, what that also does is it works to conceal the complicity of white feminists in structures of harm, in structures that uphold the very violence that we're seeking to disrupt. And so that's why I move away from talking about femicides, and I'm most interested in intimate violence. But I use the term domestic homicide instead of, say, intimate partner homicide, which is, you know, a more gender-neutral way of looking at intimate severe violence. And I say domestic because if you look at the characteristics of the perpetrators and the type of violence that happens leading up to a homicide, police who perpetrate a large number of homicides and high-risk family violence abusers share similar characteristics. And police are domestic security forces. And you take a step back and you say, okay, well, let's try to understand violence that comes from the people that are supposed to love and protect us within the home, within families. That's domestic homicide. But within our domestic security forces, we're looking at police as being also perpetrators of homicide.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Marianne, for inviting me. I had a quick follow-up question about the kind of use of terminology. One of the things that I appreciated in your book is that you also wanted to challenge the conventional ways in which gendered violence is framed by also making clear the extent to which same gender violence also happens. And so I just wanted to maybe allow you to talk a little bit about that, about the kind of research that you've seen and why it's important to also highlight that, you know, the heteropatriarchy is maybe a narrow framework in order to help us understand gender violence more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, the data tells us that queer folks and gender non-conforming folks experience intimate partner violence at the same, if not in some cases higher, than heterosexual cisgendered women. And this is data that's been replicated in quite a few places. We have large data sets now, so this is not something that's up for debate. We know that bisexual women and trans women are among the most vulnerable to specific forms of intimate partner violence, and so it's not that choosing the terminology domestic homicide, it's not about erasing the experience of cisgendered women in dangerous heterosexual relationships, but what it is about is it's like accounting for everyone who's experiencing it and doing away with the ways in which we talk about family violence that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, works to conceal our complicity in structures of power and oppression.
Can I maybe just share one of a line from your book? You wrote, advocacy movements that argue for gender exclusionary or cis normative language and frameworks are ill-equipped to provide useful data or perspectives that can inform prevention. And the key word here, prevention. Do you want to comment on that?
For me, I'm most interested in the characteristics of the perpetrator. And so, you know, as a queer person, I have had close friends of mine who have been victimized by hate crimes and almost lost their lives. And I understand that there's a lot of emotion behind wanting to call something a hate crime. And that's what the femicide movement is really advocating for. But if we don't start talking about what makes someone a killer, and if we don't start talking about the structures that teach the things that lead someone to kill, we're never going to be able to prevent it. And so that's where I'm skeptical of the way that data counting and just counting the women and girls, like, you know, we know that in Quebec, the count is at 18 now this year, which is heartbreaking. But knowing that number doesn't tell us about what are the red flags with folks who are dangerous, how can we prevent it? How can we design programs and interventions that are going to make sure that we don't continue to see a body count where the count keeps going up and up and up? When it comes to domestic homicide, we are looking at like the most predictable, the most preventable form of homicide. The red flags are there, we know it. We have known this now for 25 years. And so there's no good reason why we can't be putting in place the solutions that we need to prevent the loss of life.
So one of the really great things about your book is that it really works to provide an account of violence that takes into consideration colonialism, anti-blackness, histories and legacies of slavery, of colonialism, and so that's part of a kind of larger Black feminist practice, Indigenous feminist practice. I was rereading for one of my classes Bell Hooks's All About Love, in which she's also interested in the structural causes of domestic violence. She writes that, quote, replacing the family community with a more privatized, small, autocratic unit helped increase alienation and made abuses of power more possible. It is this dependency that became and is the breeding ground for abuses of power. And so I wanted to ask you about those forms of structural violence that you examine in your book. The legacies of Black feminists and Indigenous feminists and their kind of complex accounts of violence, and the ways that those framings help to understand domestic homicide, helps to understand the connections between state control and intimate terrorism. And then I also wonder if you might maybe share a little bit about how you, as a white person, situate yourself within this body of work.
So I consider myself to be a student of Black feminism, a permanent student of Black feminism, and I don't think that I have all the answers on how abolitionist projects should run or how transformative justice should work, should always work. But one thing that I feel is my responsibility as a settler and as a white person who's a student of Black feminism is to do my homework and to do my research. And so, you know, what I encounter all the time talking about intimate partner homicide, especially with white women working in the domestic violence prevention industry, is a lot of surprise about the fact that this is like a historically new crime. So people seem to be very taken aback by the fact that that intimate partner homicide is something that emerged with through expansion of colonialism and happened in partnership with the emergence of racial capitalism. And so, you know, I think about taking a historical perspective on those things, because it's one thing to say, okay, well, these forms of severe violence in relationships come from white supremacy, and they were brought here through colonialism. But if you look at the how, if you look at the way in which marriage and chattel laws were set up, it's only a recent historical thing on this territory that women were treated like property. That's a relatively new historical phenomenon. So when we talk about intimate partner homicide, it's really easy to say, well, you know, possessiveness and jealousy and the objectification of women, all of these things are what cause us to be killed at, you know, alarming rates. But tracing that back, going past the simple answers of saying, well, misogyny is the problem, it's like, no, let's look at the expansion of British colonial powers and look, connect the dots, the way in which the early RCMP controlled and dominated large amounts of territory here in Canada was through the use of strategic violence to scare populations, right? That's how a small number of Mounties were able to control large amounts and steal large amounts of territory. But that's exactly the same tactic that in the book I talk about how in high-risk relationships, ones that often end in homicide and attempted suicide, that type of violence, it's a strategic form of violence that's very different from other forms of intimate partner violence. So if you're asking me how I situate myself as a white person in an abolitionist movement, it's like, well, I need to account for the ways in which my ancestors brought structures of objectification and possessiveness, seen both through the ways in which the land itself was objectified and stolen and possessed by structures of white colonial power, and then making sure that we don't lose that from the conversation when we're talking about how we tackle gender-based violence, especially when possessiveness and logics of objectification are part of what underpin the type of severe violence and homicide that we do see.
As a society, we are failing to address the systemic factors that are most critical to ending gender-based violence. Governments have imposed their neoliberal agenda, transforming the violence against women movement from a radical transformational change movement to service provision focused on individualized treatment and efficiency through criminalization of gender-based violence and professionalization of the work that you've already mentioned. Consequently, gender-based violence is treated as an individual level problem, with money provided for shelters, law enforcement, and targeted intervention services. Funding has increasingly become tied to the state through legislation and judicialization, both impacting how gender-based violence is defined and understood and shaping the types of initiatives that receive funding. After numerous consultations with organizations in the violence against women sector here in Quebec, the province has made various announcements regarding funding targeted at addressing domestic violence. In May, the Quebec Justice and Public Security Ministries announced it would inject over $1 million per year for 5 years for the SPVM to create a new specialized unit for consultation and investigations in matters of domestic violence. Just last Wednesday, the same ministry announced that it would begin requiring some domestic violence offenders to wear electronic tracking bracelets next spring. The $41 million program, which will be rolled out gradually across the province, is said to be designed to give the victims a better sense of security. Considering these examples, could you speak on the importance of addressing the ways neoliberalism, criminalization, and professionalization are intertwined to shape the kind of work made impossible when it comes to ending gender-based violence?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could all talk about that for 5 hours. The way in which the funding structures and the expectations, the narrow expectations that sort of outline and define where we're able to work and how. And so, you know, of course, it always gets cited, well, a woman every 6 days in Canada is killed by her intimate partner. But yet, police have killed a civilian on average every 6 days in 2020. So it's paradoxical to me that we're still talking about funneling money to police as a way to address intimate partner homicide. So these problems emerge in a number of ways. One, police have been the only people in our communities who are doing risk assessment on scene when there's like a situation of violence where neighbors or perhaps the survivors call the police. Police are not trained to understand the specifics around what kind of violence is high risk and what isn't. And so they miss things. They miss things on the job because they're not trained. They're not experts in intimate partner violence. So shelter workers and those who work closely with survivors are much better able to understand who's at highest risk. But of course, they're not the ones who make decisions about safe housing. They're not the ones who make decisions about whether or not a charge is going to be laid. So for example, I use this, I tell a story in the book, and it's a really common one, where in certain forms of intimate partner violence, in coercive control relationships, as they're called, something so small as an abuser leaving a bouquet of flowers, like on the hood of your car or on your doorstep, can be a death threat in the context of the relationship. That's something that only the survivor, if they're lucky enough to survive that kind of relationship, would understand. And so funneling money to police not only places Black and Indigenous women at higher risk for criminalization, which is what happens when we make the police responsible for responding to family violence. In Australia, for example, they brought into place what's called coercive control laws. Coercive control laws are laws that are strategically designed to try and account for those forms of high-risk family violence that I talk about in the book. But what they found was, over a six-year period, every single Aboriginal woman in that region of Australia who was murdered by her partner had been identified as a perpetrator of violence in that relationship. So her self-defense had been criminalized prior to her death. And so funneling money to police is this narrow expectation that the only way to achieve safety is to work through the existing criminal code or to amend the criminal code. But the neoliberal approach to trying to secure safety for survivors, we see it in the shelter system as well. Organizations are under a lot of pressure to work within the carceral punitive model, and folks are facing a lot of liability and a lot of risk to their employment, and also it's heavy, difficult, trauma-exposed work when you work within the shelter system. And so the abolitionist question is, so if you have policies in your shelter that when you do a risk assessment, you have to call police in this particular circumstance, you know, or whatever your policy structure is in the NGO that you might work in the shelter you might work in, you're putting yourself at risk professionally for losing your livelihood if you step outside of that. It's a tricky thing because on one hand, we want to be critical of the way that professionalization in the industries that work to support survivors and to address violence against women has been really negative because it's fostered white supremacy within the movement, it's foreclosed any conversations around complicity, the structures of racial capitalism, settler colonialism, and how that has led to vulnerabilities. But we also want to be mindful of the fact that folks within those sectors have really good experience and expertise. So teasing out how we can secure safe and equitable and just livelihoods and to respect the expertise of folks who work with survivors, but at the same time tackle the conditions of their work, where funding streams are tied to particular interventions that always have to rely on police. That's a tricky thing. I wish I had more answers about that.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 94.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We are in the middle of sharing audio from a talk that happened in Montreal on Sunday, December 5th. The talk featured Marlahan Lopez, who is a Black feminist community organizer tackling issues surrounding anti-Blackness, gender-based violence and its intersections. The talk also featured Natalie Batreville, who is an assistant professor at Concordia University's Simone de Beauvoir Institute, where she teaches and conducts research in the areas of Black feminisms, queer theory, and prison abolition. Natalie and Marlahan posed questions to Ardith Wynot, an activist and writer who works for and with survivors of state and family violence. Ardith teaches sociology at Mount Allison University and lives on unceded Mi'kmaq territory, and she recently published a book titled Insurgent Love, Abolition, and Domestic Homicide, which was published with Fernwood Press. Here is part two of our recording of that talk.
I really appreciate the way that your work has a structural approach that kind of gives us a bird's eye view and a historical understanding of where gender-based violence comes from in our contemporary moment, but then also is interested in the kind of nitty-gritty practical ways that we can try to prevent and intervene in cases of domestic homicide. And I think that that intervention is particularly important, and you mention it in the book, because within abolitionist discourse and transformative justice discourse, the sort of quote-unquote extreme cases or most violent cases are often not really talked about. I know that even myself, you know, when people ask about murderers, you know, what about rapists and murderers? And my immediate answer is always that they're already among us. But that's in so many ways an insufficient answer, in as much as it sometimes really like forecloses a real reckoning with the reality of that violence around us. And so one of the interventions that you make is really highlighting the impact that it makes to distinguish between those forms of violence, between intimate terrorism and other forms of gender violence. And so you talk about the different types of intimate partner violence. You also mention a website, dangerassessment.org, that offers a kind of questionnaire that helps to kind of determine what type of violence is at work. And, you know, you really show that it's important because in some cases, the typical interventions that a transformative justice model might offer are actually ones that might put the victim or the survivor in danger, that might put bystanders in danger. And so there's really a kind of specificity to the approach that's necessary in those different types. And so I wonder if you could talk about those different types and how one might distinguish between different types of intimate partner violence, and then in those cases of intimate terror, what does safety planning look like? What are abolitionist strategies that can still be implemented in those cases where the danger of the victim and bystanders being killed is very real? And so I was wondering, yeah, if you could also share some sort of examples, concrete examples of what those tools might be in those cases.
Yeah, so the work on the typology of intimate partner violence comes from, that's Johnson's work. And so, you know, we often talk about intimate violence like as if it's like a monolith, right? And it sort of erases any differences that there might be. And so I think that there are dangers to putting forth like an uncritical typology of domestic violence, because, you know, we're just going to like nitpick all day, like, oh, well, this is dangerous and that's not dangerous. But I think that what's important to note is, so Johnson says there's situational couple violence. Situational couple violence is what we see most often. We probably all know someone who's been in situational couple violence, abusive relationship. These relationships can be really dangerous, so violence can escalate. It can lead to homicide. So this is the type of violence we see that comes from, it's exacerbated by addictions issues, stress, pre-existing mental health conditions, learned abusive behavior in the home. This is all stuff that we already know about. But then there's intimate terrorism or coercive control, something that Evan Stark has also written about. And that's the one that I'm most concerned with in the book, because that's the one that most often leads to domestic homicide. And so I think one of the things that I'm really arguing for is that, so if we want to create abolitionist strategies in our communities to deal with family violence, we need to know what kind of violence we're addressing, because a lot of the tools we already have, like accountability circles and ways of working supportively with the survivor and someone who's being violent, those work really well in situational couple violence. And that's what we see most often. But what we don't yet have, and I'm sad that we don't yet have this, because Insight and Critical Resistance released a joint statement in 2001 asking for this. Is an answer to what do we do with the really dangerous people in our communities, and the dangerous people are what we call intimate terrorists in a relationship. And so that intervening as community members in those relationships is really tricky because, well, one, it's not going to be someone that we're organizing with, most likely, who's in one of these relationships, because if you're in that kind of relationship, you probably have disappeared from public life in a lot of ways. So it's likely going to be someone that we are, that we know as a friend, or we have some other kind of connection to, that might not be as connected or embedded within our community. They're already isolated. But any kind of intervention is incredibly dangerous in those relationships. And what makes it extra tricky is that those relationships don't always have physical violence. Yet, the person who is the target of the controlling behavior and the coercive behavior deeply knows in their bones that their life is at risk. And again, that's where the criminal justice approach fails us. What do they do? The cops are going to show up and be like, oh, so he left a bouquet of flowers on the hood of your car? And then a survivor's like, oh no, but he didn't know where I was, and the bouquet was there because he wants me to know that I know that he's watching. Like, it makes you sound crazy when you're in one of those relationships. It's really difficult to explain. And so I think that that's a tough question. So, okay, so we know that there are certain relationships where the risk for homicide is really high. We know that the dangerous person in that relationship is likely to be suicidal. We know that they're likely to face some kind of occupational crisis. So either they have recently lost their job, they're struggling to find work, they're under some kind of extreme financial pressure, right? We know that this person may or may not have used physical violence, but they're surveilling or stalking, you know? And those are all the things that are in the danger assessment checklist. And so as movements, as neighbors, as friends, as families, we need to know the risk signs so that we know the level of danger that the survivor is in and that we might be in when we try to intervene. And so, you know, it's a tricky question, especially because in the region where I live, there's a lot of guns, you know, and in rural communities, it makes it extra tricky because access to firearms is a strong predictor of an intimate partner homicide in a coercive control relationship. So we're going up against someone who's really dangerous and someone who has a gun. But I think that knowing the risk factors, knowing how dangerous it is, means that we're going to organize differently and we're going to respond differently. We're going to be able to assess our risks and figure out, okay, so like how sneaky do we have to be about contacting the survivor? And what kind of messaging do we need to send to them? Like, okay, this is top secret. We're not going to do a call out on Twitter if you tell us what's going on, you know? So like, we're going to be able to communicate in ways that'll help us navigate those dangers if we understand which situations are risky and which aren't. Because I get very scared when I get community requests from people to join an accountability circle and then they describe what's going on and I'm like, oh my God, like, this is actually a really dangerous situation. Because I think that if we're going to do this work, it has to be just and it has to be safe. And I think that we can't be martyrs in ending family violence because we are teaching ourselves how to care for each other better through the process. And so I think that developing, you know, networks for safety, whether that means that we have to have do a GoFundMe to get kickproof doors and bulletproof glass in somebody's apartment so that it can be a safe house, maybe that's what we have to do. But it's going to be a lot different than what we would do for situational couple violence and sort of a standard accountability circle approach.
I think I have maybe two follow-up questions. One is that I think one of the things that I thought was, you know, particularly insightful was the way that you talked about those particular cases of intimate terror are often sort of misdiagnosed because people view the perpetrator of the person who will be the perpetrator of the harm as the victim, right? Because they might be in distress, they might be suicidal, they might have, you know, they're generally in crisis, and so people are putting attention towards helping that person without realizing that that person might end up being a danger to the people around them. And so that's sort of a first piece. And then The other piece of my follow-up question would be kind of about the role that, I mean, you don't really talk about this in the book, but I know that other abolitionists like Angela Davis have about like the role that media and popular culture plays in our understandings of violence. And I thought about this, a good example is actually the one that you gave about like the flowers and these kind of like warning signs that we often like feel in our bodies, but have trouble articulating. And I think that the kind of only places where we've seen those narratives and is often in films and like movies on television, and we kind of relegate them to this kind of surreal sphere that, you know, doesn't have a kind of embodied reality around us, so that when we see it, it's very hard to understand that it's like actually something that people really experience, that isn't just like a Law and Order episode kind of thing. So I wonder how we kind of, you know, as a society make that leap from, in many ways, having some understanding of how these things work from watching TV, but then actually making violence prevention an everyday skill. Like, how do we actually make it a skill that we have, as opposed to a kind of set of abstract knowledge and feeling that we carry?
So, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is a friend of mine killed his girlfriend not too many years ago. And that for me was a perfect and tragic illustration of a need for abolition strategies to account for what happens when the dangerous person is also a danger to themselves and also is a survivor. All kinds of shit that we need to be working on a lot farther upstream. And we're seeing this replicated in the place where I live, the Lionel Desmond tragedy, where Lionel Desmond, he was a Canadian Armed Forces vet who took the life of his wife, his daughter, and his mother in Guysborough County, Nova Scotia. And one of the things that the commission identified is that there was a lot of attention to his mental health and his vulnerabilities as someone who was struggling in such a way that it actually masked all the risk factors for the risks that he posed to his family during that time. And that's where I think, you know, going back to what we were talking about in terms of like misogyny can't be the end of the conversation, because when we talk about December 6th, we are also talking about someone who took the lives of women, but also took their own life, also was a survivor of severe and brutal violence in home with a father who was abusive to his mother and to him as a child. So we're also talking about a crime that could have been prevented if we had proper community-based social services and family services that addressed violence, you know, upstream. And so, you know, the situation with my friend who murdered his girlfriend a few years ago was this really difficult experience of, you know, for me personally, was knowing that he was a risk to his partner, but not being believed, because in many cases, the killer is so, is struggling so apparently with their mental health. They appear as if they're a victim of circumstance. They're a victim of racial capitalism in a lot of ways. So like the occupational trauma that happens to a lot of men in trauma-exposed work. You know, I just talked about Lionel Desmond. He was a vet. He saw a lot of horrible violence. He was implicated in state violence, and he was harmed because of that. And so we get in this weird loop of enabling toxic behaviors like stalking, possessiveness, sexual jealousy. We don't want to talk about that, because what we're trying to do is actually heal the wounds of the perpetrator. But we do it in a way that enables, because we don't know how to hold these two ideas side by side, which is that often killers are survivors too. And that's where the importance of an abolitionist perspective comes in, because the decolonial feminisms and abolitionist feminisms brought to us by Angela Davis point out that like these binaries are not helpful, because they don't help us get into that uncomfortable position we need to be in when we're like, well, hold up, I think so-and-so might be a risk to themselves, but it's really creepy the way they're talking about their partner. And I'm a little bit worried about the partner too. So then how do we deal with that together, especially when it might be a high risk situation and intervening could be, you know, risky for us. I'm missing the second half of your question. So the first, media, we were talking about media. Yeah. Yeah. So the thing that I have learned from working with killers, with folks who have survived sometimes like three and a half decades of incarceration is that, and I also know this because my friend who took the life of his partner was a really nice guy, and like, killers are not monsters. And that's where media comes in, because like, see, criminal minds, that show Criminal Minds, like this whole idea of like serial killers being mentally ill, like these deeply stigmatizing narratives about mental illness, portraying anyone who kills as a monster, really puts us back in that binary of thinking like killers must be horrible because homicide is like the ultimate moral transgression. It's the most evil thing you can do. And often this like really scary behavior that folks get into, whether like surveilling and stalking and like doing things to exert control over their partner, they also do it while they're like super polite to the neighbors, while they might have like really vulnerable body posture. And so, you know, that's where I think we do need to respect frontline expertise, and we do need to pay people to get really good to be the ones that are like the tip of the wedge between that binary, who are like, can feel it in their gut and they're educated in knowing how the vulnerabilities of a perpetrator or a potential killer can be seen alongside the vulnerabilities of the people around them. And so like, there's like a lot of media that I can't watch and I don't watch because it enrages me so much. I can't get my cortisol levels like down within 24 hours of watching the type of media that shows that killers are monsters, because we have people sitting in jail now who have been there for multiple decades who would do a really good job of helping to lead community initiatives, like working with men who are about to do the things that they were incarcerated for, and after 20 years have some perspective on that. And so I think we need to like disentangle ourselves from this idea that, you know, killers are monsters, so that we can develop ways to make sure that we are looking for accountability by helping killers heal, so that they can be the ones who are helping us do the difficult and dangerous work of intervention.
This is the Prison Radio Show, coming to you straight from the CKUT radio station, located in the beautiful city of Montreal. Though we are always fighting for prisoners' rights through our news, guest interviews, and opinion pieces, a personal, heartfelt shout-out of love and support to our brothers and sisters suffering behind bars can raise hope in a weary soul. And not only those within our 200-kilometer broadcasting area, but anyone who has access to our uploaded shows on www.ckut.ca or on CKUT 90.3 FM SoundCloud or on Prison Radio WordPress blog. We're worldwide, people. Never forget, you are not alone. We always have you in our thoughts and actions. Stay strong and keep the faith.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We're in the middle of sharing audio from a talk that happened in Montreal on December 5th, featuring Marla Hen Lopez, Natalie Batcherville, and Ardith Wynot talking about Ardith's book, Insurgent Love, Abolition, and Domestic Homicide. Here's the final section of that talk.
So, right, it was actually in listening to you talk about this, you know, this tragedy that that you experienced with a friend of yours killing their partner. And in the beginning of the book, you talk about the kind of sort of complicated, mixed feeling situation that you found yourself in as an abolitionist, but as someone who still found themselves wanting that person to go to jail, to prison. And I know that myself, in teaching about abolition, it's something that I, you know, have always tried to balance, is the reality that, I mean, you know, in the context of my classes, this job, not generally in the context of homicidal violence, but, you know, even in the context of sexual violence and intimate partner abuse and violence, that, you know, sometimes people have to do what they have to do to protect themselves, to be safe, and they have to, you know, they end up calling the police. And so I wonder as how you kind of balance that kind of tension between knowing and understanding that people, you know, can and do call the police, and often it's the only recourse that they have, especially given the kind of portrait, the landscape that we currently live in. But then also being critical of the state and of state responses. That's the first question. And then the other question would be kind of about the kind of larger abolitionist horizon of, you know, working towards ending violence. And because you really explain in the book the extent to which intimate terror, a person who is an intimate terrorist, who is exerting that kind of violence and coercion over their partner, is generally not in a position where they can be held accountable, where they, you know, are going to be sort of in a healing journey or anything like that. And yet we have to, you know, make considerations for the safety of their partner and the people around them. And so you talk about compassionate containment as something that we may have to think about. And I wonder if compassionate containment is something that is like something that we build on the way towards abolition, or if it's like the abolitionist horizon itself. And so maybe you could maybe explain a little bit more what the compassionate containment is. That would be my second question.
Really gotta work my short-term memory here. It took all those buses. So I really wanted my friend to stay in jail forever. And to be honest, like I don't ever want to see him again. And friends of mine are afraid about him getting out of jail. And I would be lying if I didn't say that I am also afraid of that, especially because I live tweeted his whole trial with feminist commentary, which I'm sure him and his defense lawyer didn't really appreciate. But, you know, there's like this quote that Miriam Kaba, and I think someone else helped to write up it, but as this piece, abolition is not your fucking feelings. Like, the way that we feel doesn't always have to determine the directions we need to move in. And sometimes, like, transformations, when I think about transformative justice, I have to recognize, like, transformation requires growth. Growth is hard. Like, you actually, like, tear in those muscle fibers to get bigger and stronger in different ways. And, yeah, so when I think about working with survivors, you know, I try to take a harm reduction approach to working with police. So it's like, okay, well, this person has access to firearms. It's a really unsafe situation. We have three of us at the kitchen table right now to deal with this. And maybe a survivor believes that police is the best way to go. So we just make sure that we have folks there who, like, know the criminal code and can advocate and can hold the police who show up accountable. And I think that that's important. And, like, some of the ways we can do that is making sure, like, asking officers, okay, what are you putting in the reporting system? Because if the survivor calls back, like, if this person returns, the dangerous person returns to the home tonight, what is the next cop on the next shift going to see in the system? Because if you don't input your notes right away, then you're just going to have, like, a bunch of clueless cops coming and, like, not being helpful and not understanding when an arrest maybe could be made. So I think that's definitely part of it. And also, like, asking questions, like, can you accompany this person to a secure shelter? Because sometimes, in some cases, shelters will give priority access to folks who are brought in by police. So if you know that in advance, and the survivor knows that they have a better chance of getting a bed in a secure shelter, then maybe that's a way you need to engage with police. But I think that also, as folks who are intervening and working with people who are in dangerous relationships, like, our safety matters too. And so I think it's really neoliberal sometimes to be like only what the survivor wants, because I think we also need to know our own threshold for engaging as bystanders and as interveners, to know that, like, when we don't feel safe, and, like, trusting our gut in those circumstances. And that's something I learned about one of the interviews I did for the book, and it didn't make it into this book, it's gonna go in the next one. I interviewed someone in Ivory Tuesday, was working with Bear Clan in Thunder Bay. She talked about, so anyone who hasn't heard about Bear Clan, Bear Clan is like, it's like the First Nation approach to community safety on the streets, staffed by volunteers, sometimes paid staff if they got a grant. to do the work of keeping people safe, like usually after hours. And I already talked about like developing those spidey senses and trusting in your gut, knowing when a situation is unsafe. That's part of the work of community safety. And so I think that if we don't feel safe around police, we can walk away. So I think that we have to like keep that in mind too, to like know if we, that we're acting within our values, because if we get ourselves shot, we get ourselves killed, we get ourselves a criminal record that's going to impact our ability to like have a secure livelihood, I think that that comes at too big of a cost. Yeah, compassion and containment. So that's this idea that I got. I can't take credit for that. I worked with women who were survivors of secure care, forensic psych prisons, and like inpatient psychiatric care with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. So like the prison populations in like Canada, the States, and Europe have extremely high rates of folks who meet like diagnostic criteria for personality disorders. And for women specifically, in the women's prison where I worked, like a big cause of having a diagnosis of BPD comes from neglect and invalidation within the family, within the home, within institutions. And so, you know, I worked with them for like 6 or 7 years, and they were really helpful for me in understanding how our abolitionist politics often forget about neglect. We talk a lot about violence. We can see violence. We can see the violence that police are perpetrating in our own communities. We can see that. We can watch it on YouTube, on Facebook Live. But it's harder to see neglect, and it's harder to talk about. But neglect is not only a risk factor for us developing maladaptive ways of coping where we harm each other, but also if you're someone who has been neglected, largely because like neoliberalism is an ethic of neglect. That's what it does. It strips away our social safety net, so we're just like floating out there in the vacuum. Neglect requires that we like hold each other close, and that we draw a bond, that we like set a boundary and make people feel contained. And that's what the folks I chatted with who had been through forms of like inpatient psychiatric care talked about wanting to be admitted to hospitals, wanting to be committed, because they wanted that feeling of being contained, because they'd experienced so much neglect within neoliberal society in other ways. And then when I have been in prisons and I've chatted with folks like who are short timing or like close to the end of their sentence, or they're like about to get on a parole, they talk about like the terrifying vastness of the community that exists outside of the prison. And like, there is something comforting to being contained and having a family and having a structure and having a schedule. And so those experiences forced me to think about like, okay, there is a role for containment. And, you know, to use Mark Lapine as an example, as a young person, long before he got access to a gun and became someone who took the lives of 14 women and took his own life, I think he was a youth who really could have used some compassionate containment, which means a space where he would have been accountable to his own healing, where he would have been able, away from all the harms that he was feeling in society, where he would have been able to heal and put himself within a social group with folks who were struggling in similar ways, with strong, grounded frontline workers who understood what he was going through. And so, you know, this is where we can think about things like community supervision. I think that all consequences like don't have to be seen as like a punitive carceral approach. And this is something like Miriam Kaba is always talking about too. Like, not all consequences are punitive. And so if we have aspects of compassionate containment, it also gives us a strategy for working with folks who are dangerous, but also a danger to themselves. And a lot of the men I work with in prison who are there for homicide, they were a risk to themselves in ways that like could have triggered compassionate care and community supervision long before they took the lives of other people and tried to take their own lives. What that would look like, I don't know. I think we gotta have those conversations as communities. We gotta have them together. But I do think that we can put healing and community accountability and community supervision together in ways that are not necessarily carceral.
You've been listening to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We've been airing pieces from a talk that happened in Montreal on December 5th, featuring Marlahan Lopez, Natalie Batcherville, and Ardith Wynot talking about Ardith's book, Insurgent Love, Abolition, and Domestic Homicide. The complete audio of the talk is available on YouTube, and you can also buy the book at the Chassin bookstore on Saint-Hubert near Beaubien Metro, as well as online at Fernwood Publishing's website. Check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show. Parts of our show are also available through podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, December 24th at 11 a.m. We are hoping to air holiday messages for people on the inside. So if you have family, friends, comrades on the inside, reach out to us with a holiday message, and also let your inside people know that they can reach out to us too. If you're listening, people on the outside of prison can email us at prison@ckut.ca or call and leave us a message at our cell phone, which is 438-337-8423. People in prison can write us via snail mail at The Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. You can also call us collect from Bordeaux or RDP prisons. We're at 514-876-3748. So send us your holiday greetings, whatever holiday you celebrate this time of year, and we will air them on our show on December 24th. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had. Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
Oh, the law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just?
If you have flu-like or COVID-19-like symptoms, such as fever, cough, loss of taste or smell, or if you have been in contact with someone infected with the virus, it's essential to get tested and to follow isolation instructions, even if you're vaccinated. Screening remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. To find out more, visit quebec.ca/test-covid-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, Joachage, Munuyang, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, December 9th, 2021. On tonight's show, two shows that you can see online and one in person, powered entirely by that one person on stage. My guest this evening, Sophie El-Assad, makes her directorial debut in Modern Myth, Antioch.
The story itself reflects a little bit how we're approaching the play in itself, is allowing us to break our barriers down and now allowing us to acknowledge that, yes, there are some flaws, but what are we going to do with those flaws and how are we going to move forward to have those important dialogues.
Norman Navratsky delves into family lore to document a Canadian travesty in Run, Navratsky, Run, Escape from Banff Prison.
Curious enough, I received a postcard in the early 1990s, which I still have, which said, you know, we are sending you this postcard because somebody from your family was possibly interned in one of the prison camps in Canada, and we want you to know about this. And I'm like, what?
And Mikhail Bielinski powers her new solo.